probably the most dangerous thing right now that people are being exposed to. It's probably even more dangerous than even seed oils, if I dare say, is just us living under artificial light all the time.
I think that's how we build the bright orange future, is just family by family opting out, whether it's traditional health care, traditional health insurance, the money. And I'm very hopeful based on sort of the trajectory I'm seeing.
Statins and cholesterol medications are, in my opinion, maybe the most dangerous medications ever produced. And they are the highest selling medications in history.
But in general, my understanding is most of the vegetables, broccoli, you know, kale, those kinds of things that we consume are really crops that have been cultivated to be edible.
In a free society, there isn't anyone dictating how I would need to treat my patients. And this is when ideal healing happens.
Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have Dr. Ahmad Amous. This is Saifedean's brother, if you're familiar with the Bitcoin standard and all of Saifedean's work. So Dr. Amous is an incredibly intelligent guy. As I mentioned in the episode, I just started working with him. I've replaced my primary care doc. We do talk about how Bitcoin fixes the corruption in traditional medicine, but a lot of this conversation is actually just very practical. What are the considerations for diet, exercise, sunlight, cold exposure, all of those things? So if you're looking for some easy to follow steps and action items, I'd encourage you to give it a listen. I think you will love this one. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got Dr. Amous with me. Dr. Amous, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Thank you, Michael. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this, not only because I think the topics that we're going to cover are incredibly interesting, but because, just full disclosure for everyone listening, I am officially a paying customer. I have fired my primary care doc, and I'm now doing online consultations with Dr. Amous. So I'm just curious, what was the genesis of your disillusionment with traditional medicine? Because you practiced in sort of the fiat medicine world for a while, as I understand. What was it that prompted you to start the online consultations and begin stepping away from what you had done for quite some time?
Yeah, I mean, so my awakening happened actually while I was still studying in medical school. Back then, my brother had stumbled into the paleo diet, and he told me about it, and I started eating a lot more meat, a lot more fat, and I felt a lot better health-wise. And at the same time, I was being taught in medical school that cholesterol is bad for you, that animal fats are bad for you, and cholesterol is the cause of all diseases. And I'm like, why does this doesn't make sense with my personal experience of how I'm feeling. So I just went, it was a random paleo website, and I started reading, they're saying, yeah, well, traditional medicine only wants to sell you pills for cholesterol, but doesn't really understand the problem. And I'm like, okay, so we have a problem here. And then that took me down a very deep rabbit hole of what else is modern medicine wrong about? And I've only been discovering things for the last, 10 plus years.
Were you eating a pretty typical like Western diet? Like, were you doing medical school in the U.S.? Was it just like a typical Western diet that you were eating prior to finding paleo?
Typical Western diet. I did my undergraduate studies in the U.S., so I had a pretty unhealthy undergraduate experience, and I was always feeling tired and not great, and kind of dealing with a lot of anxiety and depression at that point. Not really that much physical energy to work out or move. And then it was my first year in medical school, and I had moved in with my brother, and he was, you need to try this paleo diet. Just give me 30 days and see how you feel. And I told him, okay, I will do it. And I was reborn. I had humongous amounts of energy all the time. All my depressive / anxiety tendencies went away. I was always kind of like the lazy person. Now I became just the energetic person, and I was just happy all the time. And at that point, I swore that I would spend the rest of my life trying to convey this message to people. And anyone that saw me at that point, I was telling them about this diet. I was telling them what they need to do. But unfortunately, most people don't want to hear about this. And that was a really, really difficult time for me because you know, I'm just telling you how amazing I feel, and I want you to try it for your own good. But people took it personally, and people attacked me personally. And so that was a little bit of a difficult time for me. And I also, because I was so disillusioned with how what modern medicine teaches me, I thought about just quitting medical school and maybe just going and learning on my own, or maybe studying some traditional Chinese medicine or working with a chiropractor or something like that, because I just didn't like what I was being taught. But I decided to just stick with it because, you know, I've worked so hard so far and I made it to medical school, and I decided, you know, having the degree on the wall, it's probably going to be beneficial at some point. And I'm glad I stuck with it. But now at this point, I am ready to just tell people what the actual truth is.
Yeah. And I'm glad you stuck with it too, because while I understand you probably could have brought value in other areas of sort of health, I guess, healthcare more broadly, I think it's really important that people have, like, for the longest time, I was looking for a doctor in town that aligned with anything that I believe, you know, for like a couple of years, and it just wasn't obvious who that person might be. And the beauty of modern technology is you and I can engage, and I spent more time with you last week on a call than I did with a primary care doc, like an actual MD, you know, in the last 3 years, right? Like, they come in for 10 minutes, you know, check you out, like the nurse is kind of doing everything, checking your pulse and all that sort of thing. So I think, like, the attention people do there, I would say I'm a relatively healthy person. There are people who do need attention from a doctor on a level that they're simply never going to get until they get truly very sick. And then you go to the oncologist, and yeah, they'll spend lots of time with you because you're dying. But that's not very helpful, right? I mean, if you can start at the beginning and fix the root cause of those things. Something I'm curious, because I'll tell you my experience in a minute, but when you first started this, you have all this head trash, I assume, of like how medicine's supposed to work, cholesterol's bad. Were you concerned at all going into it? Like the first time you got your blood work done post paleo, my LDL's high or whatever. Did you still have like those lingering doubts about what you were doing?
Honestly, I mean, at that point, I developed this connection with my body that I never had before, and I understood that it's kind of a gift to be able to be so sensitive to how your body feels, and I trust that more than any blood work. I trust that more than anything that any other person can tell me about my body. I trust my own instinct. And I've experimented with several things, and some things have made me feel worse, some things have made me feel better. And that's usually my guiding point. I never have any worries because anything that is probably bad for me, I will feel it.
Yeah. I think that's a safe approach. The interesting thing for me is I went down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, and it led to all these other things. And it was Safe who actually got me trying the carnivore diet. I told you offline that, you know, I did that for I think 18 months and felt much, much, much better until I didn't. And so I've reincorporated no vegetables, but fruit, raw honey, raw milk, some of those things. I did have, though, I was still early enough in my journey of being skeptical of everything, which I now am just very much so, that when I think maybe 6 months into doing carnivore, I got my blood work back, went to my primary care doc because it was just like an annual checkup. And he's like, well, most of your numbers are good. Your cholesterol is horrible. And so my LDL was off the charts. My total cholesterol was off the charts. The funny thing is HDL triglyceride, that ratio is great, which, as I understand, is maybe a better proxy for, you know, for measuring your overall health. But he started talking about, he's like, you know, at your age, probably don't need statins yet. But in 5 years, if this is still what you're doing and this is how you're eating, you're probably going to need statins. It was like that moment. I wasn't concerned about what he was telling me because I knew he's shilling pharmaceutical, you know, companies all day long. But I still had like these lingering doubts about, is cholesterol not the problem that I've been taught to believe it is? And I'm curious, is that something that you experience with patients who are still, like struggling through, like they understand sort of what you've described here. Like hypothetically, yes. Okay. You know, it makes sense, but everyone else is telling me that I'm going to die of a heart attack when I'm 45. Is that like a constant sort of back and forth that you're having with people?
Yeah. I mean, cholesterol questions are some of my most popular consults, and I understand why it's so scary. You talk to the average Joe and they tell you the first thing they think about when they mention, when you mention heart attack or stroke is cholesterol. But this is all a propaganda. The studies are clear. If you look at, well, is there actually a link between elevated cholesterol and your risk of heart disease and stroke? No. Do that actual, how much do these medications help? Very little. How much side effects do they have? A lot. So it's very clear once you look at the data. And I mean, it's definitely like, I wouldn't just trust anyone on the internet who's saying random things about issues. You should probably talk to a physician about these issues if you're worried about them. And I am happy to help with that because I've done the reading about what actually is the cause of heart disease, what actually is the cause of stroke, and how cholesterol is not what's causing it.
Yeah, because like I've seen these studies. I saw this interesting. It was more like a meme a year or so ago, and it was this. It pointed to this study that a high protein diet causes all of these problems, and then it's like the protein that they supplemented with. It was one of these packaged protein shakes with seed oils, and it's like 20 extra grams of protein, tons of additives, artificial flavors and colorings. And you like that, for me, that was sort of the eye-opening thing that just simply taking, if you don't have the knowledge, the lexicon to analyze these studies in sort of medical detail the way someone like you do, it's very easy to fall prey to, high protein diet. It's like, no, if you just understood the absolute garbage that they supplemented with to get one group of the study onto quote unquote high protein. And by the way, it's not even that much higher protein. It's like 20 extra grams a day. You realize very quickly that you've got 30 confounding variables in the form of all of these additives and all the nonsense that they put in there. I agree with you. I think the challenge for most people probably, and hopefully this is the role you feel like you're, the gap you feel like you're filling, is having someone who is stepping back beyond sort of the mainstream narrative and looking objectively at the data. Is that maybe the value that you see yourself providing, is like this professional opinion on these things that other professionals have already sort of blindly weighed in on?
Yes. And combined with the experience of seeing what people in traditional medicine, what ends up happening to them once we do put them on cholesterol medications, and how they still end up getting heart attacks and strokes versus people that do it the natural way, fix their diet, fix their light exposure, and how much better they eventually become. So that is how proper medicine should be.
Yeah. So how would you pinpoint then? So I guess two questions maybe. What are the side effects of things like statins? Because there are so many people on them, probably a lot of people even listening to this podcast. And then what would you sort of trace back? And I know a lot of variables here, but in general, what are the things that you tend to believe cause heart attack, heart disease, those sorts of condition?
I mean, so cholesterol is simply a fat that is going around in our vessels, and it has very important functions such as generating hormones, such as generating neurotransmitters, feeding brain cells, etc. It also has important repair functions. So if there's a nick in one of your blood vessels, cholesterol goes there to try and fix that. If there's inflammation there, cholesterol goes there to try and fix that area. And so if you do look at someone who has a heart attack, if you look at that vessel, there is a plaque of cholesterol there. But the reason the plaque of cholesterol, the issue is not the cholesterol plaque itself. It's that there was inflammation in the blood vessel that caused, that needed repair. And that's why cholesterol came there. Okay. So there is no point in fighting cholesterol. Cholesterol is just the firefighter there at the fire. You need to look at what caused the fire in the first place, which is inflammation in the blood vessel and overall inflammation in the body. there are multiple reasons why people would have inflammation in the body, and each person is different. Some of the most important things are diet, vegetable seed oils, which we've only seen, they've only been introduced in the diet over the last 50, 60 years. And also artificial light exposure and our lack of exposure to the sun. These are all factors that are driving inflammation in the body and driving the way our mitochondria are able to generate energy. And yes, so by targeting cholesterol, cholesterol has such many important functions in the body. By reducing the amount of cholesterol in the body, you are reducing many important hormones that your body needs. And also, because cholesterol medications work on this pathway called the malolactate pathway, which actually all your cells use to generate energy. So at a very, very basic level, cholesterol medications are preventing your cells from generating energy properly. And this can have manifestations everywhere. So one of the most common side effects is muscle aches, because your muscles are unable to generate energy efficiently. And so you end up building up lactic acid more and your muscles break down more than people who are not on this medication. So that's one side effect. This is the most common one. And this is one that thankfully you can kind of detect because you get symptoms. The more scarier ones are the ones that affect the nervous system. So you need cholesterol in order to feed brain cells. You need cholesterol in order to repair your nervous system. And once you're reducing the cholesterol that's reaching your brain and reaching your nervous system, you are increasing your risk of some crazy conditions, including dementia, including all sorts of neurovascular disorders. And there's plenty, plenty of anecdotal evidence of people who have stopped statins on their loved ones and seen that their memory instantly improves. If they've had some dementia, they're falling less, they're stronger, they're no longer like losing weight. And it's all because it affects such an important part of energy generation in the cell. Studies on statins don't really mention these side effects very well. They design studies in a way so that what they do is they tell people over the first 2 weeks, do you not feel better on this medication? And if they say yes, they remove them from the study. So that they're self-selecting for people that will tolerate the medication more. And they're also, they know how to not report the data very well, to hide things in studies. But statins and cholesterol medications are, in my opinion, maybe the most dangerous medications ever produced. And they are the highest selling medications in history.
So do you think if you prescribed instead of statins to particularly like an older population, folks who are maybe more inclined to dementia, Alzheimer's, if you promoted like a very high fat diet, took them off statins, is that something you would just expect to see reversed rather quickly? Or is the damage done? And so maybe it gets a little bit better, but you know, they've like, you know, what's sort of the mechanism by which that might help?
Yeah, I mean, so like my experience, my personal experience, my grandfather got a heart attack when he was 85, and he already had some memory issues. He still got around. He still knew where he was. He just forgot. He would forget what happened to him last week. I came to see him after his heart attack a week after, and my family was telling me for the last week he has not been himself. He wakes up in the middle of the night. He sometimes get lost in the house. Doesn't know where he is. He's having difficulty feeding himself. And I instantly looked at the medications he was started on, and he was put on a statin. I stopped it, and the next day he was back to how he was before the heart attack.
Crazy. So
in some cases, it could be that dramatic. In cases where it's been many years of worsening memory and these medications, it might be more difficult. But it definitely doesn't hurt to stop the medication, because instantly the cholesterol synthesis goes up in the brain. But I mean, dementia has a lot of causes to it, and these need to be addressed all together in order to improve someone with dementia.
Yeah, it's fascinating, because I'd heard the dementia that dementia is a common side effect. My dad, I think, went on a statin briefly for a period of time. And fortunately, I think my, I credit it all to Bitcoin because these are the rabbit holes you start to go down. I told him I thought he needed to be very careful with that. And he had, I think he'd expressed maybe feeling a bit lethargic. With some of us, it's not so obvious if it's taking our memory away, because we tend to forget why we walked into a room to begin with. But those are very serious side effects. So I'm going to skip ahead here because I want to talk about diet, because you and Saifedean don't necessarily see eye to eye exactly on diet, which I think would surprise a lot of people. So for anyone listening, if you don't know, Dr. Amous and Saifedean Amous are brothers. So Saifedean talks very openly about a carnivore diet. My understanding is it's basically meat, salt, water, not really much else. You did that for a while. Why don't you share your experience in that, and then what you've reincorporated and why, and how that's benefited you?
Yeah. So, I mean, when I first started the paleo diet, paleo is basically, just avoiding sugar, avoiding processed food, avoiding wheat. And I felt incredible on it. After a while, you kind of like, there's diminishing returns where, when you first start, it's as if the next day is always better than the day before. It's always like you're getting better. But after a while, after a year on it, you kind of plateau. And so I started experimenting around a little bit, and I started cutting down on the carbohydrates. And I did feel better to start with. And I was cutting down. Eventually, I became very low carb. Only just some basic vegetables and meat. And then I heard about the carnivore diet and decided to try it. And I felt amazing at the beginning. Maybe the first 6 months, it was just completely, you're no longer just hungry. You never get like these hunger. You never feel that I'm hungry, I need to eat right now. Felt a little bit more energy. I did lose some weight. And at that point, it was starting to become like I'm losing too much weight. And for the first 6 months, it felt amazing. But then I sort of started not feeling too well. I was sleeping a lot. Didn't really have that much energy to work out. My gut didn't feel very good. There is a bit of a cult experience around the carnivore community. So I kind of stuck with it. And, you know, there's always these discussions on the carnivore groups. Oh, you're probably not eating enough fat. You're probably eating too much protein. You are probably eating the wrong cuts. You are not drinking enough water. You're eating too much organ meats. You're not eating enough salt. I tried all these things, and for a year and a half, I was trying to fix it, and it just didn't work for me. And eventually, I happened to try some fruit, and I felt a lot better. And so, and ever since I have some fruits on a regular basis. I would have some sweet potatoes also. And I feel a lot better. And I don't want to go back to the carnivore. I don't think that it's the ideal diet for everyone. It definitely works for a lot of people. And it's definitely helped me, because when you start off going very low carb, it kind of helps fix up your metabolism at first. And that's why a lot of people feel good on it. But I don't know if it's the best long-term strategy for everyone.
Yeah, I would tend to agree, because I had a very similar experience. It was about 18 months into the carnivore diet that I just started to feel lethargic and much more tired. And I sort of felt the same way, like, well, I must be doing something wrong. It must be the fat content, the macros, you know, something like that. I think that the issue now in retrospect that I have with thinking that way is our ancestors weren't counting macros, right? Like, they were just eating very intuitively. And it would seem logical to me that if humans came across a patch of berries or an apple tree or honey or those sorts of things, that those would be things that they would consume. What do you think about, I guess in general, vegetables? Because to me, that's still sort of a sticking point. Like, the only thing I consume besides, the only carbs besides fruit, honey, raw milk that I consume are sweet potatoes. But in general, my understanding is most of the vegetables, broccoli, you know, kale, those kinds of things that we consume are really crops that have been cultivated to be edible by humans, because if you look at what like wild broccoli looks like, you would never eat that except maybe to survive. And even then you might rather die. So what's your take on vegetables?
Yeah, I don't really do vegetables. They're just kind of difficult to digest with not that much nutritional content. I've shifted away from the also being very low carb. I don't necessarily think that's also for everyone, and I don't think it's necessarily a long-term strategy for everyone. So having some starches in the diet is not a bad idea. So that's why, I mean, potatoes and sweet potatoes are fine with me. Fruits is fine with me. In general, vegetables are just difficult to digest, and they're filled with defense toxins such as oxalates, which kind of increase inflammation in the body and cause other symptoms. So I'm not a big fan of vegetables. It's not the end of the world if, you know, once a month I am invited somewhere and they have some vegetables with the food and I would have it. My understanding of my body also, since I first improved my diet, I sort of became also very conscious of other things in my body, especially light environment and sunlight. And so if you're also optimizing those as well, you have a bit more leeway with your diet, in that, you know, you can mess up once and you won't really feel it the next day. I still don't mess around with sugar or candy or processed foods, but, you know, an occasional vegetable every once in a while is fine. I still don't see the value of eating vegetables for the sake of eating vegetables, because there's not that much nutritional value in them.
Yeah, and they taste a lot worse than anything else that you've described eating. So to me, it's like, if it's not bringing me serious nutritional value, I'm not gonna suck it down. So you mentioned sunlight. This is a journey, it seems, because I've heard you mention and reference Dr. Jack Cruz on many occasions. We talked about him in our discussion. I've learned a lot from him. Most of the time, I'll be honest, I don't know what the hell he's talking about. I try to like just absorb the punchline of like, what's my takeaway, the practical like protocol implementation. What is it about sunlight that's intrigued you? What have you learned? And what's sort of the function of that in your health journey?
Yeah, I mean, so sunlight is critical to health. Sunlight is one of the cornerstones of life. The sun is the source of all life on the planet. We evolved living outside under the sun throughout history. It's only been recently where we've just been indoors, away from the sun, and the worst part, under artificial light. So your body can use the sun directly to power your mitochondria. Mitochondria are tiny organelles, tiny part of your cells that generate energy for your cells. So without mitochondria, you won't be alive. You eat food in order to generate electrons that go into your mitochondria to generate energy. But this process can happen on its own just from sunlight. So that's how powerful sunlight is. You know, you anecdotally hear people who say, you know, I was on the beach all day, I don't really feel that hungry, I just want to grab something light. And it's because of that, because you're getting loads of energy just from the sun directly. And so that's the importance of the sun. The morning sun is especially critical, because that's your hormones for the rest of the day, your neurotransmitters for the rest of the day, they rely on the morning sun in order to, oh, okay, it's another day, let's get started. If you don't get that, if you're inside under artificial light or you're inside in the dark all day, you won't get a healthy level of these neurotransmitters, and they're just all over the place and your hormones are all over the place. And this can lead to a lot of diseases.
What is the... So I imagine there's a significant role that this plays in sleep. Is sleep quality and quantity of sleep something that you've dug into a lot? I don't think we talked much about that.
I mean, 100%, yes. We probably, the most dangerous thing right now that people are being exposed to, it's probably even more dangerous than even seed oils, if I dare say, is just us living under artificial light all the time. And the main problem people have is that our days are not bright enough and our nights are too bright. So by saying that days are not bright enough, we're not going outside in the sun enough, because, you know, the flux energy that we are getting from the sun is just hundreds and thousands of levels of magnitude compared to the artificial light that we're getting inside. And then, so you're not getting enough light during the day. And then at night, you suddenly all the lights are on and you are getting very bright nights. And what this does is that there are certain hormones that you need to, your body is synthesizing all day, especially cortisol and melatonin. So the way it works is you want to generate cortisol in the morning to give you the energy to go out to, you know, go hunt, go work out, go do your thing in the day. And then those levels should slowly go down up until sunset, where they're getting to their lowest point, until you get to bed where they're usually at the lowest. And also at sunset, you should start generating melatonin. And melatonin is not just a sleep hormone. It also has very important anti-inflammatory and anti-cancer properties in the body. So ideally, you should be, you know, your entire day you've had this cortisol go up. At night, it should start going down. And at night, your melatonin should go up. But if, say, sunset is at 7:30, you've been inside all day, and then all you kind of dark, and then all of a sudden you turn on the artificial lights in the house, that increases your cortisol. You're getting this energy, you're getting your blood sugars going up, and it's messing up your metabolism, and that's messing up the quality of your sleep.
So do you have like I'll tell you something we didn't talk about on our call is I fall asleep very easily, very quickly. Like I'm talking 60 to 90 seconds, always have. My wife is concerned that I don't get enough sleep. I've started waking up at 4 a.m. I have three young kids. I started waking up early so I can get a workout in, get some stretching in, sit in the sauna for a little bit, like do some things that are just, you know, I'm sort of in a time crunch once the kids are awake, once I start working and that. So I'm probably getting, you know, 5.5 to 6 hours of sleep a night. I definitely think it's a compromise that I'm making for, you know, a few years while I'm young and kind of able to handle that. Is that too big of a compromise in your view? Assuming that it's, you know, 5-6 years from now, hopefully I'm sleeping kind of a more normal full night of sleep.
Yeah, I think it's difficult to judge for each person because we all have different biologies and different lifestyles, and you should optimize. I mean, the best way to do it is to optimize the quality of the sleep. So that is the first step. And, you know, if you're functioning well on 6 hours of sleep, then it's very possible that your body just does well with that. And this is also, you know, like it's important to be able to do that without needing like artificial lights that are causing you to get to that point. So if you're able to wake up with the sunset and, you know, sleep close to sunset, wake up with the sunrise and sleep close to sunset, then that's a good sign that you have enough energy levels. It's not artificially being pumped up by fake light, etc.
Yeah.
6 hours is usually pretty decent. 7.5 would be a little bit more ideal, but I've seen a lot of people do well on 6 hours.
Yeah. And the way I see it is there are very few trade-offs I make when it comes to my health. Like I told you, like I haven't eaten dessert in 2 or 3 years now. I mean, I focus on, local, grass-fed, grass-finished beef is my primary nutrient intake, organic fruits, vegetables, raw milk from a local farmer, those sorts of things. And so for me to, you know, I guess it's like a temporary trade-off I'm willing to make. My hope is that someday I'm just going to bed at night when I'm tired and I'm waking up in the morning when my body tells me it's time to wake up. And in the meantime, I'm trying to fit in anything I can before the house gets crazy. So we've talked about, you know, well, actually let's talk about exercise because this was an interesting conversation. So I've had this, sort of journey of exercise where I've basically been a pretty consistent weightlifter, since college, I would say. And I've been consistent. I haven't been consistently like rigorous and disciplined and like progressive overload. And so I could probably be a lot beefier than I am if I was better about like really focusing in my training. But when we talked, you kind of brought to my attention some of what you do And it seems a lot more functional and practical than trying to see how much you can deadlift, right? So why don't you talk about what you do and for, you know, your clients who are coming to you and saying, hey, like, what's sort of the minimum I need to get in? What types of exercise should I be doing? Like, what would you sort of broadly design as a program for them?
Yeah, I mean, first thing I would say, I'm not a big fan of cardio for the sake of cardio. Just jogging or, moderate intensity cardio. It's on the long term, it's not very good for you. I mean, if you think about it evolutionarily, our ancestors weren't ever jogging. You're either walking in the forest, or if you're being hunted or hunting someone, you sprint after them. So the in-between is kind of not good. And it's not good because you're sustaining your heart rate at a high level for a very long time. And in order to do that, it's driving your stress hormone levels up. And this on the long term is not very good for your cardiovascular system and also for your muscle mass. Having a good muscle mass is important at old age, you know, so that you don't easily fall and break your hip. And also, you know, muscle mass has been associated with longevity at older age. So the best way to maintain a good muscle mass, in my opinion, is resistance training. And it doesn't have to be, you know, going for 4 or 5 days a week to do heavy lifts. I did that for a while and it feels good and you look good and you feel very manly and you feel like you can fight anyone, which is great. But if you want to be a little bit more functional about it, I'm a big fan of body weight exercises. So I do a lot of pull-ups, a lot of push-ups, a lot of body squats. And I feel that, they kind of keep your muscle mass equal in line with each other with the rest of your body. So I like that a lot. An important thing to note is that you want to work out a muscle not more than once a week. If you do it more than that, then you are the muscle hasn't really gotten the time to recover for the next workout, and you're just you're not testing it to its maximum potential.
Yeah. And that's, so what I'm trying to experiment with now, cause I was doing a program that focused on, you know, heavy weights, progressive overload, proper form and, full range of motion. I think a lot of good things. I'll tell you, it's a hassle that, like, you know, especially when you've got young kids and a job and you're, you know, trying to squeeze this in. I think a lot of people are going, they're spending probably a lot more time in the gym than is functionally necessary. So what I'm trying right now is doing a few days a week with, you know, at least 48 hour rest in between, but doing lots of push-ups, lots of pull-ups. The only weight that I'm planning on picking up for the next month or two as I sort of experiment with this is a kettlebell, to do kettlebell swings, because I think that's a good posterior sort of full body exercise. But then air squats and really just focusing on that. And then I think you talked a little bit about yoga as well when we were chatting. I mentioned one of my greatest weakness as like an athlete is flexibility, mobility. Like I can assure you, I am the least flexible human being you have ever spoken to. It is pathetic. So I'm going to incorporate some more yoga. I'm getting my stretching in. What are you still doing yoga? That's a part of what you incorporate as well.
Yeah, I do 10 minutes to like 15 minutes every morning just to, you know, open my body up for the rest of the day so that I have good posture and stuff. And every few days I would do a longer 30 minute or so yoga class. I feel that it's good. It connects you to your breath. It keeps, we suffer from sitting down all day or even standing all day. And it messes our posture. It's a very unnatural way. So yoga is one way you can kind of realign these imbalances. So I'm a big fan of yoga.
Okay.
Again, I've gotten the diversity of the workouts and the movement that I do. I have more freedom now that I spend less time in the gym. So that's something I experiment with. I have less muscle mass than I did back then, but there's this advantage there, but there's also advantages that I found elsewhere.
Yeah, yeah. So you mentioned connecting with your breath. Is any sort of like coordinated, organized breathing exercise besides yoga, is that something that you do or think about?
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I've been doing Wim Hof every morning for maybe 5 or 6 years. Big fan.
I've heard of Wim Hof. I haven't looked into it deeply. What's the protocol? How long does that take? I hear it's a kind of a interesting sort of thing that Wim Hof has come up with.
It's like a 15 to 20 minute breath work. It's his own method that he invented from studying a lot of schools of, you know, Hindu sort of medicine and yoga. And the way it works is you hyperventilate for 30 to 40 breaths, and then you try and hold your breath for as long as you can. So I'm currently at the point where I can hold it for 3 or 4 minutes after that hyperventilation.
Wow.
And what that is doing is you're kind of driving up your sympathetic or stress system at first when you're hyperventilating, and you're doing the exact opposite by when you stop breathing. And kind of like just the balance of these two in a short period of time, you kind of feel that you're in control of your nervous system for the rest of the day. That's how it feels like to me. You're in control of your breath for the rest of the day. You're in control of your nerves. You're in control of your sympathetic system. And I'm a big fan. There are other schools of breath work that are also very good. Buteyko is a very well-researched one that also works very well for a lot of people. But I think doing even 5 minutes of some sort of breath work is great. And I feel the difference. If I don't do breath work for a while, mentally I feel it, physically I feel it.
Yeah, I can believe that. That's something that I've sort of done in little spurts here and there, and probably never spent enough time doing. So you mentioned Wim Hof, you keep sort of transitioning me into topics I wasn't planning, but you mentioned Wim Hof. Part of his sort of thing is like cold exposure, right? He does like extreme, like he can go sit in like an icy creek in the tundra for like 5 hours and like it doesn't bother him. Do you have thoughts on cold and heat exposure?
Yeah, I mean, so cold is incredible. Cold is an incredible healer and incredible teacher. And actually, if you going back to the mitochondria, studies show that, you know, cold exposure can make your mitochondria generate light photons on their own. So you're able to generate energy just from being exposed to the cold. And it's just that's how your semiconductors work. That's how your cells work. So the cold is excellent for a lot of people. It's especially important for people who live in colder environments in the winter. If you're inside all day in the winter, you know, under in artificial heating, your body kind of doesn't realize that it's winter time, and so it's not good for your hormonal balance, for, you know, the way your metabolism works. You need some cold exposure, especially in the winter. And, you know, it tends to be that the coldest months are the months where we're getting the least amount of sunlight. So a good way to energize your body is to get exposed to the cold.
Okay.
I will mention this, though. I've seen a lot of people overdo it with the cold. I mean, a lot of people overdo it. They overdo it with fasting, just like they overdo it with cutting down on carbohydrates and the carnivore diet. Eventually, all these things drive up your cortisol, your stress hormones. And for a lot of people, their issue is trying to decrease the stress that you have in your day rather than increase it. So that's why, you know, the cold is not just universal for everyone.
Is there a duration that you, so like if you have a cold plunge, say, is there like an amount of time you'd spend in it, a number of times per week you do it, and like a time of day that might be optimal?
But honestly, different people have different ways of doing it. My personal thing is in the winter, there are just some days where I'm feeling low energy or the sun is not out. I have to start my day with a cold shower. That's what I do. Maybe 5 minutes under the cold water. That's usually good enough. The longest I've done is 12 minutes. There is no rule for it. It depends on how you feel and what kind of setup you have, etc.
Yeah. So it kind of same sort of concept as diet, I guess. It's, you know, you sort of have to feel it out in the latitude in which you're living and the nature of the other factors in your life. How much sunlight are you getting? What are you eating? The quality of food, all of those things probably factor into how much cold exposure would be beneficial and when are you overdoing it. And this is the thing, I think people just need to continue experimenting, right? And they're sort of, it sounds to me like you're sort of painting this like big circle around the things that are fair game for people to try. And there are obvious things outside of that circle, like seed oils and artificial light at night and all of the noise and the nonsense in the world. But within this sort of circle of good, healthy habits, you've got to figure out what works for you and the duration and the volume and all of those, which I think is really important, because for myself personally, I can say, I don't know that I've dialed anything in perfectly yet where I have perfect energy and, you know, obviously not perfect sleep. I mentioned that, but I've progressed a lot since deciding to kick off this health journey where I just went strict carnivore and I thought that was the solution. Okay, well, maybe it's not the solution. Okay, how much carbohydrate do I incorporate? Does my fat then need to be adjusted? And it's just a matter of like feeling a lot of these things out is kind of what I'm hearing. And I would say that's my personal experience. Is that about right?
100%. Yes, 100%. There's no easy answer for anything. And there are low-hanging fruits, but there are also things that you need to work on and study and understand how they work for your body.
Yeah. So I've got to ask them, because we talked about cold exposure. And by the way, my intention for our podcast was to talk about the corruption of medicine. So I want to get to that for a few minutes before we wrap up. But heat exposure, sauna, steam showers, like any sort of, intense heat exposure. Do you have thoughts on how people might leverage those?
I haven't read about it as much as I would like. I know that it does help a lot with detox, especially like heavy metal detox, and That's very good. I like it. It's great for the skin because you sweat out, your skin feels good. It's also like there's a bit of a meditative aspect to it where you're, you know, teaching your body to tolerate the heat. And so I like it. I don't know too much about the long-term effects but yeah.
So moderation, find what works for you.
Yeah, I don't see it as being wrong or bad for the body, but I don't know of the direct benefits, to be honest.
Okay. So I'm done asking you for protocol advice. I had to sort of this is for my own benefit, but hopefully I think people are looking for protocols or at least sort of rules of the game within which they can operate. So you've best you can so far opted out of traditional healthcare medicine. What are some of the most practical examples of corruption that you saw both in medical school and that you still see in sort of the traditional medical community?
Yeah, I mean, so controversial topic, but it has to be, we have to talk about it because people need to be aware of this. But childhood vaccines, so, I mean, going into medical school, when we went into our pediatrics rotation, I thought that they're going to come to us and explain to us, okay, so why do we give this vaccine at this age? What is the history of this disease? How did the vaccine help get rid of it? That's what I expected. But instead, the first day of the pediatrics rotation, they just gave us the CDC schedule and they told us, this is what we do and this is what we're going to do to kids that you see. So I wasn't happy with that answer because I had already wasn't happy with a lot of the things that they were teaching me. And I went down that rabbit hole and what I read didn't really satisfy my curiosity. I wasn't convinced with what they told me. And this is something that I would definitely recommend that anyone who's thinking about vaccinating their kid or not thinking about it, they should do their own research. Don't just blindly listen to what your pediatrician says. There's a lot of nuance to it. And you can talk to me, you can email me if you would like more information about it. But this is definitely one thing that is that I think about. The amount of money that drug manufacturers make through these injections is quite obscene. And they don't have to go through the same testing and studies as other pharmaceutical medications. So that's just something that people should be aware of.
Yeah, that's a hot topic for, I think, a lot of people. I mean, I think for many, the COVID vaccine is sort of an obvious one to skip at this point. But yeah, like as a father of young kids, I mean, we've just recently moved in the last year or two. We've got to pay out of pocket for this doctor that they don't require the vaccine schedule. I haven't dug into either. There's so damn many vaccines now, but I haven't dug into each one individually. But each one I have looked at, I've yet to hear a compelling case for why it's necessary. Right. And like, it's,
I have yet to either.
Okay. that's good to hear. Cause, like I remember when I learned about like these synthetic vitamin K1 shots that babies get injected in, it's like, it's not even the vitamin K that they need. And presumably in my mind, at least if the mother is eating enough grass fed butter, she probably has the vitamin K to share with the baby, and the baby's probably fine. Right. So like, why are we doing this thing instead of just telling the mom, hey, you're pregnant, make sure you're consuming the foods that are going to nourish your child so you don't need anything supplemental when they come out. That's sort of the whole point of motherhood, I think, is, you know, that you're able to provide what the baby needs. So I'm with you 100% on childhood vaccines. It's the reason my family's made many of the decisions we've made over the last couple of years. Are there, would you extend beyond childhood vaccines sort of this point that there's simply so much money to be made on any number of these, you know, whether it's vaccines, whether it's statins, whether it's other medications, Ozempic and all of these, GLP-1 agonists, that probably the answer is just something much more natural and intuitive, like you're talking about. And the corruption really comes down to follow the money, and you can pretty much figure out why certain things are being pushed onto, you know, the populace.
100%. And the key point here, and Bitcoiners would like to hear this, it's not free market pharmaceutical companies that are causing this. It's not because, you know, people are greedy and this is what's causing this. The fundamental issue is these pharmaceutical companies are in bed with government agencies to try and ban all other alternative schools of thought, all other modes of healing. And this actually happened in the early 1910s, surprisingly around the same time when the Federal Reserve was created, which is the creation of the Flexner Report. The Flexner Report was... this guy, Abraham Flexner, worked with the American Medical Association to try and optimize medical curricula in the U.S. But he had very strong ties with the pharmaceutical companies. And what they actually did was ban all other alternative ways of treating the body. They weren't alternative at that point, but any non-pharmaceutical-based medicine, medical schools were banned at that point. More than 60% of U.S. medical schools were shut down, just so the only prevailing medicine taught to everyone is pharmaceutical-based medicine. So at that point, people would go to a healer, to a doctor, but he would practice homeopathy or osteopathy or naturopathy. That people considered that a doctor. But ever since that report was created, now all we consider a doctor is someone who pushes pills. And you are unable to do that in a society that has, you know, that government is not very big in, that government doesn't have unlimited amounts of money to fund itself in order to fund its operations, to fund all these centrally planned processes. And this is why I think it's critical we know that, yeah, this is how Bitcoin will fix this.
Mm-hmm. So basically the dissidents have just been completely silenced. And you can see that with, I haven't looked at this in a while, but some of the things that health insurance is, you know, permitted to cover, and then the things it's not permitted to cover. Like I remember my dad going to sort of a functional medicine guy years and years ago, and he was talking to him about just like, you know, one of them was talking about like getting massages, and my dad asked him, he's like, is that like a, you know, would that be a good thing for me to do on a regular basis? And he said, I think that'd be a really good spend of your, you know, your healthcare dollar. And, you know, I mean, besides like the obvious sort of physical benefits, like the, you know, stress release, all those sorts of things, pharmaceutical companies are never going to pay for you to get a massage. And on some level, that kind of seems like it would be silly anyway, but they are willing. I mean, my understanding is some pharmaceutical companies will pay for you to pretend like you're a different gender, but they won't fund, you know, something that would materially benefit your life if you were consistently doing it. And they won't fund you. They won't help you buy grass-fed beef, but they will help you take Ozempic. And it's just totally backwards. So Bitcoin does fix this. And in your view, is it's really just the mechanism by like it's having this scarce money that can't be thrown around to special interests is effectively kind of what it comes down to. You can only purchase influence for so long when you only have so much money and the money printer doesn't continue to fund these things.
Yeah, there shouldn't be a middleman between a physician and the patient that they're treating. I want to treat a person in the way I want to treat them. Nobody should intervene with that. There could be guidelines to help how I can treat them, what some suggestions, but there shouldn't be a mandating body telling me how I should treat people. And that's the way it is right now, is there are certain societies, say the American Medical Association, the American College of Cardiology, they write guidelines on how medicine needs to be practiced. These societies are heavily funded by pharmaceutical companies. So you can imagine that their guidelines are very, very drug-based. If you don't obey these guidelines while treating a patient as a physician in the US, you are legally liable and insurance wouldn't cover any payment, anything you perform that's outside of the guidelines, and you are legally liable for not treating them according to the guidelines. Having this central society in charge of how a physician practices, this large, you know, centrally planned process is only possible by a government, you know, giving it free money. In a free society, there isn't anyone dictating how I would need to treat my patients. And this is when ideal healing happens.
Yeah. Well, I definitely couldn't agree with you more that having that middleman between you and the physician is, you don't realize how corrupted that process is until you step beyond it. Like we canceled traditional health insurance and went over to crowd health. And the reason besides some of the just the frustrations dealing with the insurance carriers was I wanted to be able to go into a doctor or anyone who I needed to work with for any sort of medical care and say, this is between you and me. I'm self-paying. This is my money. This isn't, you know, some rigmarole with the insurance company that you have to, some song and dance that you have to do. So I need you to, you know, and what I found too is that I could go to a mainstream physician and I could say, I don't really care what you have to say about X, Y, and Z, because that's not why I'm here. I need this blood work prescribed or what have you. And like they'll just write me a script for the blood work and I can get in and get out. And I just paid them for, you know, rendering a service, like much more free market, versus I was more or less forced to, hey, if I'm going to keep seeing you as a patient, you have to come in once a year, do the blood work I prescribe. I'm going to give you my thoughts, which by the way, I don't care about because I think your thoughts on this are particularly stupid. And you just end up in like this vicious cycle of just sort of like nonsense. When you have the power as the patient to just say, I'm paying, you render the service, and I tell you what it is that I need from you, I think it positions people to make much better decisions because it's their dime. It's their money that they're using to do so. It's so broken. And I'm not quite clear. I don't know if you have any thoughts on like, besides moving to a Bitcoin standard, which I think is our, you know, utopia, and fixes a lot of these things, maybe as we sort of close out here, what are some of the practical things you think we could get done to begin making progress on fixing what's broken in medicine?
Yeah, I mean, the people need to move away from the old system. That's that I think is the key. I don't think the old system is going to fix itself. I think it's just going to have to fither away and die, and we're going to have to build a better one. And the people are already kind of starting to do that. They are following the advice of, you know, random physical therapists and physicians online, and listening to influencers and gym bros and fixing their health rather than listening to their physicians. And I think that's the right approach. This is just going to grow more and more and more because there's value there. People are actually healing themselves. People are actually getting better. And yeah, more and more services like mine are available for people to just talk to a physician directly, no middlemen. And the more that we have of that, the less reliant on the old system we will be. And this new system is definitely going to be better because it is peer-to-peer and it's not third-party run. And eventually that system is going to grow and it's going to become what, you know, rational people go to for health advice.
Yeah, I think maybe a way of thinking about it for anyone listening is live so as to catch the attention of the people in your sphere of influence and have them start asking questions like why how are you so healthy? You know, you're busy like I am. How are you? Why do you feel financially free? And you can talk about Bitcoin, you can talk about the way you eat, the way you reject the notion of pharmaceuticals as a necessity or sunscreen as important to protect yourself from this life-giving force that is the sun. And I think more and more people are asking those questions. You're right. Like, I can tell you, my wife she homeschools our kids, and there's this community of people who are growing their own food, waking up to the corruption. They haven't pieced it all together exactly, and they've only kind of gone down one or two of these rabbit holes. But I think that's how we build the bright orange future, is just family by family opting out, whether it's traditional health care, traditional health insurance, the money. And I'm very hopeful based on sort of the trajectory I'm seeing. So, okay, I've got one last question for you. One I ask everyone at the end of the show, and that is, you probably have a lot of these to pick from, but what is an unpopular opinion that you have, and you get bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners with it?
Okay. This is something I've been thinking about recently, and I think, I guess some people know a little bit about it, but we need to put more light onto it. But our addiction to our phones, our addiction to social media, our addiction to technology, we've benefited a lot from technology, but we are starting to see the negative effects of it. You jump to your phone, not because you also want to see that the thread and you want to scroll a little bit. You're not only addicted to that, you're also addicted to the actual blue light that your phone is emitting. So just be very careful of that. We don't really have long-term data of people who've spent, 30 years of their life using their phones for 6 hours a day. So we don't know what the consequences of this is. We already know that people are getting addicted. People are having eye issues. People are having sleep issues because of it. So just be aware of that. Try and dedicate more time that's technology-free, that's phone-free. And as much as help as, you know, as technology has a role in our lives, let's try and have a healthy relationship with it.
Yeah, that is prudent advice, because I can tell you the one way my life has gotten worse since finding Bitcoin is I was never on social media before, just kind of rejected all of it. And Bitcoin Twitter in particular is a fun place for me to be, because it's like my people and, lots of ideas and all the banter's going on there. But it's a dangerous trap. And again, as someone with young kids, it's an example that I'm setting for them and like an expectation of my attention that they have. So very prudent. And I agree with you on the light. By the way, I've got this, I don't know if it's actually useful. I found this screen protector that helps reduce some of the blue light and convert it to red light for my phone, which is it's like one of those things that could be a total gimmick, but for, you know, $40 or something, I'll try it and see if maybe it helps. But yeah, get off your phones. I do agree with that. Dr. Amos, this has been a lot of fun. I think this has been maybe one of the more practical episodes I've had. Like, people are going to be able to listen to this and move forward with something and begin trying and experimenting in their own lives. Why don't you give a handoff? I'll just show you one last time. Our conversation last week when I signed up as a client was awesome, way more productive, you were way more attentive than any doctor's been that I've talked to in the last 35 years of my 35-year life. So kudos to you. Tell people where they can find you.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate the kind words. I have a website, amousmd.com. On Twitter, I'm Amous at AmousMD, and on Instagram as well. Happy to talk to people. You can send me a message on Twitter. You can shoot me an email. Yeah.
Perfect. I love it. Well, thank you so much for the time. Look forward to catching up again in 6 months when I get some revised blood work done. Hope to have you back on the show in the future too.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
Cheers. And that's a wrap. Again, hope you enjoyed this conversation. I know I did. I could talk about this sort of stuff all day. If it's not Bitcoin, health is one of my favorite topics of interest. Make sure you go check out Dr. Amous's website. Schedule a call with him. It's not cheap. It's not free. He doesn't take insurance. I get it. But if you're looking for a doctor that aligns with you on some of the most important fundamentals of your health, this is the guy to go to. He's also a Bitcoiner, so we love to support those folks. Of course, if you need help with taking your Bitcoin into 100% self-custody, no KYC, no counterparty risk, no nonsense, no compromises, no shortcuts, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast, schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We can also help you with online privacy, setting up your privacy phone. We have a Plan B residency option for everyone trying to escape tyranny wherever they may be. Again, it's thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can also follow us on X at @thebitcoinway_. You can follow me there as well at @theothermjordan. And of course, if you would like to feed this algorithm that we are trying to constantly channel our energies into, give us a like, subscribe, comment, share this podcast with someone who you think might find it interesting. I would really, really appreciate that. Until next time, stay safe. Stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.